questions and observing them up close. But do not wait until further indicators are exhibited, because it may be too late. Based on the combat profiling heuristic, you must do something. For the Marine in a combat environment, the decisions are kill, capture, or contact. For the civilian in a potentially unsafe situation, the decisions are run, hide, or fight. Each situation will be different. A security agent in a public transportation facility may decide that their hierarchy of decisions is question, detain, or subdue. A civilian in the same location might consider report, alert, i.e. sound an alarm, or run. A police officer on patrol may have to decide between shoot, arrest, or question. Regardless of what situation you find yourself in, or what role you are playing at the moment, you must have a set of pre-established decisions to make based on what you observe. Otherwise, you'll freeze, take too long, or make a decision that is not in your best interest. These three steps are a basic guide to establishing a baseline, thinking about how you will identify anomalies, and be ready to act quickly. This is for your safety and that of others. Following these steps will keep you left of bang. 3. Establishing baselines everywhere you go. As discussed above, when arriving in a new area, the first task is to determine what is going on in the area you are operating in, observing the geographic and behavioral patterns. Although each setting is unique, the general approach discussed above will help in establishing baselines for every place a Marine might encounter while deployed. However, there is another way that a Marine can shorten the time needed to go through that process, and that is by finding similar locations here in the States with which to draw analogies to places overseas. If a Marine unit expects to conduct a high number of vehicle or personnel checkpoints, there are a number of places to practice establishing a baseline. A person could observe the behavior of people standing in line at a Department of Motor Vehicles, at a TSA checkpoint at an airport, or even a border crossing checkpoint. By initially analyzing the behavior of the people at the checkpoint, observing each domain one at a time, and then analyzing behavior encompassing all of the domains, Marines can quickly establish a baseline for that setting. The more experience combat profilers have at analyzing people and places using the six domains, the larger file folders they will create and the quicker they will be able to make observations in new environments. This is particularly true if combat profilers can observe situations at home that mirror or provide analogies to situations abroad. If a unit expects to be operating in a mostly rural area, Marines could observe the behavior of people who work in similar industries. There could be a great number of similarities between the behavior of a field worker in the U.S. and a farmer overseas. Combat profilers may not be able to find parallel experiences at home for some situations they will face overseas, such as IED attacks. In situations like these, Marines and soldiers need the ability to conduct a mental simulation of what they would expect to be the baseline for the event. This will dramatically reduce the time needed and make sense of what is occurring when they arrive at a chaotic scene. The high degree of uncertainty and the element of the unknown can cause stress that limits your ability to think clearly in these scenarios. Taking the time before you deploy to list any possible contingencies you may respond to and discussing them with people who have experienced similar events on previous deployments can help you to build templates for those contingencies. Consider the scene around a gang shooting. To establish an immediate baseline for this event, it is safe to assume that the deceased victim would become a center of focus for the surrounding people. However, only people who are familiar with victims or who have an interest in them would approach them, proximate pull. These people may be first responders who want to provide first aid and save the person's life. They could also be people who want to remove things from the body, either something that they own and want to get back, or to steal something that they want from the victim before the police arrive. With the exception of those two groups of people, We would expect all the other bystanders to be proximally pushed away from the victim, as they would have no need to get any closer. We would expect people who had no warning that these two men were going to be killed to be shocked at the event, causing them to display a cluster of uncomfortable behaviors, while someone who anticipated the event may show a lower degree of interest in the scene, because they saw it coming. We would also expect people to be showing a submissive cluster in response to the scene, as they realize that two people are now dead. The other extreme of this situation would be people who are so angered by the event that they display dominance as they become emotionally aroused and experience a rush of adrenaline. With these very basic assumptions formed for a baseline, we may consider the Los Angeles event by first examining the girl. Her body language shows that she is interested in the scene. Her feet, torso, and gaze are all directly oriented at the victims. We could conclude that she is feeling uncomfortable, since she is displaying pacifying behaviors as she rubs her clavicle and has crossed her arms across her chest. These observations fit our initial assumptions, leading toward the decision that she fits the baseline and does not warrant any additional attention at the moment. Shifting to the other person and observing the female wearing a white sweatshirt and capri pants, we come to a similar conclusion as the first female. She has covered her mouth with her hand, which is a response often associated with surprise and grief. Since she also fits the baseline, she does not need any immediate attention. The third female, wearing a white shirt, jeans, and white sneakers, however, is an anomaly and does not fit the baseline. First, one foot is oriented toward the scene, and the other foot is pointing away from the scene, showing that she may be preparing to leave the area. Her divided interest causes her to stand out from the other two women. The other indicator is the hands-on-the-hip posture, which we classify in the dominance cluster. The fact that she does not fit the baseline and stands out as an anomaly does not indicate any wrongdoing, but it requires at least contacting her to find out what information she may have about either the victims or the shooters. Anytime Marines attempt to establish a baseline using either analogy or a mental simulation approach, they will arrive on the scene with a set of assumptions. In many situations, the assumptions will initially far outweigh the facts. Because combat profilers may enter a situation with a high degree of unconfirmed assumptions, the need for accurate and actionable information is very high in order to raise their awareness about the event. The benefit of our approach is that they can quickly adjust their assumptions and fill in the gaps of information. We believe that there will be enough similarities between various situations in the U.S. and analogous situations overseas that developing initial assumptions will shorten the time required to develop a baseline while deployed. Without a baseline, you will have nothing against which to compare your observations, and no way to assess initially whether or not a person is an anomaly. The intent of combat profiling is to increase a Marine's situational awareness and survivability. By practicing establishing baselines now, you can decrease the time needed to isolate the enemy and minimize the chance of an enemy hurting you. 4. Identifying key leaders. Understanding human behavior is hugely beneficial to Marines and helps them gain the upper hand in their daily lives while at home or deployed. Application of this understanding is most helpful for Marines as they attempt to identify key leaders in any group of people. While often the leader will willingly identify himself, there could be situations in which he conceals his role. Often, combat profilers must observe from a distance and will not have the benefits of being introduced to the key leader. How, then, can key leaders be identified? Human behavior and group dynamics are key. In relation to combat, in highly kinetic scenarios, a sniper team capable of identifying a leader from 1,000 yards away with a high degree of certainty can provide several options to the ground commander. They can kill that leader, maneuver ground forces to detain the leader, or continue observation to gain more information. In counterinsurgency situations, where there is a greater need to influence the local population as a means of gaining intelligence to root out insurgents. Identifying the local leaders and power brokers in a village is critical. The key leader indicators discussed here are not limited solely to enemy leaders, but any leader within a group of people. The made man. In the Italian mafia, becoming a made man is associated with status, respect, and a higher level power in the organization's hierarchy. To help Marines remember the four main behavioral indicators for leaders, we use the acronym MADE. These indicators are mimicry, adoration, direction, and entourage. Anytime you observe these elements of behavior, you can be reasonably certain you have identified the leader of the group. Entourage. The first indicator for identifying key leaders is an entourage. In fact, it's a necessary indicator, since it's difficult to identify a key leader of a group without a group. An entourage is simply one or more people around the leader. This may seem obvious, because the well-established fact in leadership research is that interaction is one of the main activities of leaders. While the leader needs others around to control or give guidance, having an entourage comes with additional requirements. An entourage, which may include a messenger, a bodyguard, or a trusted advisor, provides a benefit to the leader. The President of the United States has an entourage made up of the Secret Service to protect him, a group of advisors to provide counsel, and support personnel who handle any task he needs done. Everyone around him provides a benefit to him because he is the leader of that group. Even though leaders will not always have an extensive an entourage as the president, an entourage will still be present. The leader must also provide a benefit to their entourage, whether it is money, guidance, drug connections, or protection from authorities or rivals. Some reason exists for the entourage to choose and support the leader. To determine the roles of individuals inside of a group, answering questions about who is providing physical protection for whom and who is the center of attention can facilitate this effort. Direction. The second leadership indicator is direction. The leader provides direction for the rest of the group. A leader who is significant will be in control of his subordinates. Giving direction is often a kinesic indicator designed to control the actions and behaviors of others, and could either be very obvious or very subtle. Military commanders often evoke the image of giving obvious direction as they order their different units to push forward, hold firm, or any other action they require. While obvious indicators of direction are easy to identify, such as pointing or motioning, combat profilers must also look for subtle indicators of direction. Subtle indicators could be a nod, a wink, stroking a beard, or something that would not attract much attention, yet would still convey specific guidance to others. Oftentimes, junior leaders in an organization are easier to identify than their superiors, because the junior leaders are more apt to give very obvious direction. In an attempt to exert control or make a name for themselves, they will very likely be more overt in their actions, very clearly ordering their subordinates to take certain actions. They are more likely to be offended if their orders are disobeyed. Senior leaders who have progressed through the ranks and are usually more mature may not feel the need to continuously display overt dominance. They may feel more secure in their position, or do not want to attract the attention of others, which in a criminal enterprise may result in detention or arrest. Subtle indicators of direction may be more indicative of the true shot callers. As the human eye is naturally attracted to movement, kinesic cues associated with direction are often what will initially capture our attention and allow us to identify other leadership indicators through sustained observation. Adoration. Adoration is the third key leader indicator, and can be defined by positive displays of admiration and respect toward an individual. These can be verbal and nonverbal, as well as overt and subtle. Verbal adoration includes language of respect. This can be calling someone sir or ma'am, addressing a person by title, such as military rank, doctor, etc., or using formal language reserved for people of higher status, as in languages such as Korean. Nonverbal adoration encompasses actions and gestures which show deference toward another person. Overt signs of adoration include gestures such as saluting, bowing, or kissing the hand. Subtle signs of adoration include things such as walking behind the person of higher rank, holding the door open, standing in a posture of submissiveness, physically sitting at a lower height than the key leader, standing while the key leader sits, looking to the key leader for acknowledgement, etc. In many situations, criminals or even locals who are friendly toward us will not want to overtly indicate who their key leader is. It is fairly easy to temporarily refrain from showing overt signs of adoration. However, it is very difficult to keep from showing subtle signs of adoration toward a superior because they are so ingrained in people's behavior. Behavior will betray intentions and relationships. With sustained observation, combat profilers can confidently identify the key leaders and decision-makers in any group. Mimicry. The last leadership indicator is mimicry, which includes the subconscious gestures, mannerisms, facial expressions, postures, speech patterns, accents, and other behaviors that people display which are identical to those they are interacting with. Research has shown that mimicry is a positive element of group dynamics that establishes rapport and increases positive relationships between group members. Mimicry was even a method employed by our ancestors to survive, because in the harsh conditions in which they lived, social isolates did not survive. Mimicking another person's actions demonstrates respect, and often people subconsciously and naturally mimic those whom they respect. While behavioral mimicry can be a deliberate act and done intentionally, also important are the elements of mimicry that occur outside of conscious awareness. These are true indicators of social standing and authority. Because people show a higher degree of mimicry when they are interacting with others by whom they want to be accepted, combat profilers should look for the person who initiates a specific behavior, as well as the people who match or mimic that behavior. The leader will often be the dominant person in the group, and therefore the one who first assumes a posture, expression, or gesture, which is subsequently mimicked by the rest of the group. When done outside of conscious awareness, mimicry will show where a person's true respect lies, and may not always sync with an accepted hierarchy in an organization. Many companies, militaries, and social groups have a person who has been chosen to be the public and visible leader, while there is a strong-willed second in command who is the glue in the organization and has earned the trust and respect of those with whom they work. Subtle displays of mimicry will help you find who the real leaders are in any group. Finding the made man. In situations where you can observe 4 out of 4, or even 3 out of 4 indicators previously discussed, you can be reasonably certain that you are watching the leader of the group. Other times, you may be alerted to the presence of a leader based on other aspects of the profiling domains, and the preceding indicators can be used to supplement your observations. As each situation you find yourself in will be slightly different, these indicators may help you identify the leaders in the groups you are observing. Finding and targeting these people can not only improve your effectiveness, but also improve the perception of your capabilities. Counterinsurgencies can turn into a war of information, and those with the most influence can greatly affect the outcome. Finding those people with influence is a significant way to tip the scales in your favor. 5. Staying left of bang. Attacks from within. Workplace violence. Insider threat. Or green-on-blue attack. Call it what you will, but the reality remains the same. Those who are supposed to be able to trust violate that very trust by conducting a violent attack against their own. For U.S. military personnel, the threat of green-on-blue attacks has risen considerably in the past few years. According to one ongoing database, green-on-blue attacks, attacks against coalition personnel by members of joint security forces, more than tripled from 2010 to 2011. The most attacks occurred in 2012, with approximately 44 separate incidents resulting in 61 coalition deaths. From January 2008 until October 2013, there were approximately 85 green-on-blue attacks, resulting in around 140 killed and 159 wounded coalition personnel. The reason for this increase in attacks by Afghan security force personnel is largely due to the heightened risk resulting from the increase in joint operations, such as patrols, and the increased mentorship roles that coalition forces have assumed. More interpersonal interaction results in a greater risk. The causes of these attacks mainly fall into two categories. First, tensions resulting from cultural differences and interpersonal conflict. Second, infiltration and influence by insurgent groups. In August 2013, the International Security and Assistance Force Commander, General John Allen, stated that up to 25% of green-on-blue attacks were the result of insurgent infiltration. However, the majority were the result of personal grievances. As long as Marines and other U.S. military personnel continued to work alongside host nation security forces, the threat of these types of attacks will remain. The key is to take the necessary steps to mitigate these attacks and train our own security forces to stay left of bang. The problem of green-on-blue attacks presents a very complex scenario for the military, as the mission in Afghanistan is to train and develop the Afghan National Security Forces, ANSF, so that they can take charge of their own national security. This is a mission that requires well-developed relationships between the soldiers of each country and a high level of trust between mentor and mentee. If the American military treats every Afghan soldier as a potential threat, taking away their ammunition, searching them at checkpoints, and treating them as second-class citizens, these relationships will be destroyed and the mission will fail. On the other hand, the ANSF can't be treated as harmless, and the military can't completely let their guard down. That approach would expose our forces to an unacceptable level of risk, and would likewise cause the mission to fail. Because the impact of green-on-blue incidents strains this relationship and jeopardizes over 11 years of combat, threats inside the wire have attracted the attention at the highest levels of the military and government. In addition to green-on-blue attacks, our forces have occasionally been the victims of deliberate blue-on-blue violence. Usually the phrase blue-on-blue is used to refer to incidents in which U.S. personnel fire upon other U.S. personnel, whether by accident or through negligence. At times, however, blue-on-blue violence is the result of a U.S. service member, contractor, or government employee attacking other U.S. personnel because of deliberate and malicious intent. One of the highest-profile examples in recent times has been the case of Major Nidal Hassan, U.S. Army, who killed 13 people and injured more than 30 others at Fort Hood in 2009. More recently, in September 2013, Navy contractor Aaron Alexis shot 15 people with a shotgun, killing 12 of them, after entering the Washington Navy Yard with a valid ID card. Since these are not the only examples of this type of attack, the insider threat is always a risk that needs to be considered. The American military is not alone in experiencing workplace violence or insider attacks. A 2001 report estimated that 1.7 million violent victimizations occurred in U.S. workplaces between 1993 and 1999. 75% of these were simple assaults, although less than 1% were homicides. An entire industry exists to provide training, advice, and security assistance to prevent and respond to workplace violence. Additionally, we have become increasingly aware of events such as school shootings and other types of attacks in places we previously thought were relatively safe. On one hand, these types of attacks are a part of the larger issues of crime we face in the U.S. According to the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program, There were approximately 1,214,462 violent crimes nationwide in 2012. On the other hand, issues such as workplace violence and school shootings seem more threatening, more unbelievable, perhaps because they occur in places where we should be able to trust that our children and we are safe. In many ways, workplace violence and school shootings parallel the green-on-blue and malicious blue-on-blue attacks our military personnel experience here and overseas. Various studies have defined civilian workplace violence by four main categories. Civilian Type 1. These include violent acts by criminals who are unconnected with the workplace. These are acts such as robberies. Civilian Type 2. These include violence directed toward employees by customers, clients, or others that the organization provides services for. Civilian Type 3. This is defined as violence against employees by other current or former employees. Civilian Type 4. These are violence acts committed in the workplace by someone who doesn't work there, but who has a personal relationship to an employee, for example, a spouse or partner. From the perspective of deployed military forces, we may disregard the Type 4 incidents for several reasons. However, Types 1 to 3 relate to the types of violence that our military forces experience, which can also be broken up into four categories. Military Type 1. Violent acts by insurgents and other hostile forces against U.S. patrols or bases. For example, patrol bases or forward operating bases. Civilian Type 1. Military Type 2. Violent acts by locals who are not a part of an insurgent group. Civilian Type 2. Military Type 3. Violent acts by assumed coalition personnel, i.e. green on blue. Civilian Type 3. Military Type 4. Violent acts by fellow U.S. personnel, i.e. malicious blue on blue. For example, Major Hassan. Civilian Type 3. The military Type 1 events equate to traditional attacks against U.S. forces by insurgents or other hostile forces. But these are expected. The usual training, precautions, and security measures apply to deny the enemy the ability to conduct these attacks. Offensive tactics, such as dispersion, 360-degree security, and overwatch, help to mitigate some of the risks of these types of attacks. Defensive obstacles, checkpoints and barricades, security positions, and other measures help to create defensive standoffs to keep hostile forces out of our positions. However, these types of risks come with the job, and it's combating these types of attacks that our military personnel are best trained to deal with. The military Type 2 are those in which local civilians, who are not active members of a hostile or insurgent group, attack U.S. or coalition forces. These are often the result of grievances, such as the loss of a child or other family member. Civilian casualties are an ugly reality of violent conflict, and often fuel negative sentiment against militaries and other security forces operating in the area. These attacks may be spontaneous or premeditated. In the types of environments in which U.S. forces are currently operating, it is extremely difficult to distinguish between these types of attacks and military Type 1 attacks, which involve recognized enemy forces. The same types of tactics and defensive measures help to mitigate the effects of these attacks. Nevertheless, it is critically important that we attempt to minimize civilian casualties and treat local civilians with respect. Insurgencies and even policing missions require the support of the local populace. The two types of attacks that are defined as insider attacks are types 3 and 4. These are violent acts conducted against our own forces by the people we should be able to trust the most, fellow coalition partners, and even our own military and defense personnel. Until recently, these types of attacks had been relatively rare, although not unknown. Our military personnel need training to be able to prevent these acts from happening. Combat profiling can provide a number of tools to stay left of bang. Combat profiling gives Marines and other military personnel three tools to help prevent insider attacks. The proactive combat hunter mindset, the ability to identify pre-event indicators, and the ability to make quick and accurate decisions with little time and little information. Combat hunter mindset. The FBI suggests that one way to survive workplace violence is having a survival mindset. This means being aware, prepared, and having rehearsed the actions you will take during a workplace violence incident. Those who prepare and train themselves for the possibility of violence will react differently than those who do not. Those who are not prepared will likely panic and will ultimately become helpless, conditioned black. Those who are prepared will still experience anxiety, but will be more likely to maintain awareness and act effectively in a stressful situation, possibly going as far as condition red. Rather than a survival mindset, we recommend that you have a combat hunter mindset. The first element of this mindset is maintaining a condition yellow awareness level. It means maintaining your situational awareness. The reality is, however, that it is not always possible to be in condition yellow 100% of the time. When a person focuses on reading an account report, is engaged in an important business-related conversation, or conducts a number of other tasks, that person's situational awareness will be limited, or possibly even lost. However, there is no excuse for walking around the entire day completely unaware of your surroundings. After reading a report or finishing a task or conversation, everyone should assess his or her surroundings. This may only take a few seconds, but may be the difference between being a victim and being a survivor. For Marines and other deployed service members, it is also not possible for every single individual to be completely aware and searching for threats at all times. However, they have an advantage in that Marines and soldiers can be assigned to serve as guardian angels. These are personnel whose job it is to be on the lookout at all times for potential threats. Additionally, military forces can establish and maintain various security measures not available to many civilian organizations, such as security checkpoints and personnel searches. This means that military bases abroad are very controlled environments, and instead of letting this lead to complacence, Marines and other security personnel should recognize that the security measures in place provide for an even greater ability to identify potential threats and prevent attacks. Identify pre-event indicators. Attacks do not happen out of the blue. Even what may be considered spontaneous violence is almost always the result of a gradual progression of aggression and precursors to violence. In order to conduct attacks, terrorist groups must plan, prepare, reconnoiter, rehearse, stage for the attack, move to the location of the attack, and numerous other things before actually conducting the attack. The same can be said about the workplace shooter, the rapist, or the violent assaulter. However, as the FBI states, it must be pointed out, however, that no single behavior is more suggestive of violence than another. All actions have to be judged in the proper context and in totality to determine the potential for violence. Nevertheless, the key to preventing many attacks is identifying the pre-event indicators. Combat profiling focuses on observing behavioral indicators that someone is a potential threat. These include autonomic indicators of emotions and stress, biometric cues, behavioral indicators of aggression, kinesics, violations of interpersonal distance and other movements that attackers make, proxemics, and various other behavior clues that a person wants to do another person harm. Military personnel, or anyone in a workplace, should look for these and other indicators that someone may be planning or preparing to conduct an insider attack. Behavioral indicators. Combat profiling is primarily a method of behavioral analysis, analyzing a person's behavior to determine their emotions and intentions. We expect to see similar type behaviors from someone who is planning to conduct an attack. Nervous behaviors, uncomfortable cluster. Personally and physically conducting an attack against another person requires a great deal of risk. The attacker is at personal risk at a number of points from initial planning to the actual attack itself. Most people will be uncomfortable with the chance of getting caught or having their attack thwarted. Drug dealers, shoplifters, smugglers, and even suicide bombers would rather not be caught. Instead, they want to accomplish their goal and carry out their mission. Additionally, people have a natural aversion to pain, injury, and death. Human nature produces a strong desire for survival, and very few, if any, people can or will walk into the face of death unaffected and undeterred. Even the most idealistic suicide bomber. That being the case, anyone who seeks to accomplish a task in a situation where there is high risk of getting caught and a significant potential for injury or death will experience nervousness and fear as the survival instinct kicks in and releases a number of hormones such as adrenaline. Concealing the plan. Uncomfortable cluster. Prior to the actual attack, any individuals who are involved in planning the attack will likely exhibit secretive behavior. This will likely be expressed in various ways. On the one hand, a potential attacker, or any individual involved in the plan, will seek to hide the fact that an attack is being planned and prepared for. This may result in avoidance behaviors or proxemic pushes away from those who might be able to intervene and prevent the attack. On the other hand, a potential attacker may also exhibit aggressive behaviors as a correspondence to those inquiring about the secretive behavior. In these cases, the person may exhibit a behavioral cluster shift from uncomfortable to dominant behaviors. Both of these types of behavior will likely be outside of the normal behavioral baseline for any given person and should be reasons for suspicion and potential action. Interest in the target. An attacker will have to observe, learn about, and ultimately get close enough to the target for the attack to be effective. Depending upon the type of attack and weapon being used, an attacker may have to get extremely close for the attack to be successful. Suicide bombers must be within feet of the target. Over a period of time, an attacker will exhibit a consistent pattern of being proximally pulled toward the target. The attacker's behavior will indicate interest in the target at a level that will be unnatural. At the time of attack, the attacker will move in a way that is mission-focused, aggressive, and indicative of being on the hunt. Proximically, the attacker will move toward the target with a purpose. Consider the analogy of a hunter or predatory animal. A hunter must acquire the prey, observe the prey, potentially follow the prey or wait for the prey, and eventually close in on the prey. Hunters observe their prey in order to identify patterns of behavior. Surveillance exhibits unique behavioral indicators that should be obvious to the combat profiler. The same can be said about following or tailing. The actual attack may necessitate that the attacker close in on the target. This approach, proximic pull, may be unusual. Unusual timing, unusual speed, unusual person. It may break socially accepted proximic rules. Planning. Acquiring or attempting to acquire information about security, routines, schedules, or other types of information for which the person has no reason to have. Accessing databases outside of their work-related requirements. Observing individuals in an unusual manner, following certain individuals, or asking about personal matters of fellow co-workers inappropriately. Contacting people outside of the organization to share information. Preparation. Behavioral indicators of increased stress and/or negative emotions toward fellow co-workers. Verbal or written communication that a person is thinking of doing themselves or others violence. Increased interest in weapons, talking about, purchasing, etc., or violent media. Testing security measures. Decision-making. Quite often, many people see one or more pre-event indicators leading up to an insider attack, but fail to do anything about it. They brush it off, rationalize it, don't report it, or don't make a note of it, and ultimately forget about it. This discussion is not a call to be suspicious that every coworker is plotting a major attack, or to be hypervigilant to the point of distraction, so that your colleagues become uncomfortable and suspicious of you. Rather, the purpose of this section is to convince you that many incidents of workplace violence and insider attacks can be prevented through people being proactive. As the saying goes, if something doesn't seem right, it probably isn't. The keys to responding well in a situation are knowing when to make a decision, knowing what decisions to make, and rehearsing those decisions so that when it comes time to act, your actions are immediate and spontaneous. The combat profiling heuristic requires that when you observe three behavioral indicators that someone is an anomaly, you act. However, sometimes it may be necessary to act on one or two indicators, provided those indicators are clear and obvious in communicating a person is a threat. Combat profiling also requires that you have a set of predetermined decisions to make in the event that you observe anomalies or pre-event indicators. For the Marine in combat, these are kill, capture, and contact. For the civilian walking about, the decisions are run, hide, and fight. For civilian workplace violence incidents, the decisions may be talk, report, and intervene. First, contact the individual. Engage them in conversation and ask probing questions to further determine if the person may actually be a threat. Second, if the conversation leads you to believe that the person is a threat, or if the indicators are clear enough, immediately report the person to the appropriate security personnel and/or authorities, and provide as much detail and information as possible about why you think the person is a potential threat. Third, intervene. We would never recommend that a person purposefully put himself or herself in danger, but depending on the situation, this may be necessary. Intervention could be verbal or physical, alone or with a group. Nevertheless, the third option is chosen when a violent incident is imminent and other options are unavailable. Combat profiling gives Marines, soldiers, other law enforcement and security personnel, as well as civilians, the mindset and knowledge to identify the behaviors and events leading up to an attack. Combat profiling increases your survivability. The combat profiling domains are uniquely designed and capable of preventing the insider attack because they train people to realize when a person has those violent intentions and provide the ability to determine if he or she is capable of carrying them out. Preventing the attack. We must do everything possible to prevent insider attacks. Because most insider attacks are the result of interpersonal problems, it is important that leaders take an interest in the welfare of their Marines, soldiers, and employees. Military personnel deployed abroad and who are working closely with host nation security forces cannot afford to risk their own lives and the lives of their comrades by treating their host nation counterparts disrespectfully. Preventing an attack may be as simple as respecting those we work with, treating them with dignity and like valuable members of the team, and respecting their culture and values. Unfortunately, interpersonal conflict will always arise, and violence may be the response. Additionally, some attacks are ideologically driven. In regard to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, ideology trumps every other level of human need. Even if a person has his or her basic needs taken care of, is safe, and is in an environment in which they are respected and valued, that person may still have a deep ideological problem with the organization and people around him. This is the case for people like Major Hassan. The only way to prevent attacks from folks like these is to establish the proper security procedures and for everyone in the organization to maintain awareness, report any pre-event indicators, and intervene if necessary. 6. Developing your profiling ability. We evaluate people all the time, quite attentively, but but they only get our conscious attention when there is a reason. We see it all, but we edit out most of it. Thus, when something does call out to us, we ought to pay attention. For many people, that is a muscle they don't exercise. Gavin DeBecker. When you first started driving a car, there were a number of different tasks that you had to simultaneously accomplish for you to successfully drive the car safely. Since you were a novice driver, your focus was internal to the car, and your attention was directed toward accomplishing all of the tasks. The acts of using the turn signal, checking your mirrors, changing the radio, changing gears, carrying on a conversation, and turning your headlights on were all independent tasks that required concentration and effort for you to accomplish separately. It wasn't until you had spent countless hours behind the wheel that those tasks became very simple and automatic, something you simply did as part of the drive. As you became more comfortable inside the car, you also became more comfortable and aware of those who were around you on the road. You became a better judge of how much space you needed to make a left-hand turn through oncoming traffic. You learned how to assess the relative speed of a car approaching in your rear-view mirror. You learned the areas that highway patrol officers would likely be in to catch you speeding. And you learned the indicators that would alert you to an erratic driver that needed close attention. The same type of development is required for you as a profiler. Early in your development, you will find yourself focusing a great deal on one single domain. You will likely be very obvious in your efforts to watch people, and will likely attract attention to yourself. You will also find it difficult to profile while simultaneously being involved in a conversation. Over time and with more practice, this process will become fluid. But it takes practice and effort. The time that you put in each day to develop this ability will lead to you becoming capable of automating the tasks involved in profiling into your life the same way that you became a better driver. This will let you look farther ahead down the road and see all of the possible ways a situation could play out. Becoming an expert. The goal is to become an expert combat profiler and to be so adept at profiling that you do it intuitively. The ability to carry on a mentally taxing conversation while simultaneously analyzing the verbal and nonverbal indicators, the cues that are being presented, is reserved for the peak performers. This is a great goal to have. However, the reality of the matter is that it could take you up to 10 years before you reach this level of proficiency and expertise. I tend to believe that, to become a true expert in the field, a decade of experience could be necessary to reach the pinnacle. I also believe that there are some steps that we can take to become better profilers today, as well as set ourselves on a path to attain the expert level. To do this, let's take a look at what makes somebody an expert in their field. Gary Klein is a renowned and expert researcher on decision-making, and cites the following aspects that experts have the ability to see which novices do not. 1. Experts see patterns that novices do not detect. 2. Experts see anomalies, events that did not happen. 3. Experts see the big picture, situational awareness. 4. Experts create opportunities and improvisations. 5. Experts have the ability to predict future events using their previous experiences. 6. Experts see differences too small for novices to detect. 7. Experts know their own limitations. With an understanding of the differences between the experienced and the novice, we begin to design a plan to overcome the shortfalls. Fortunately, understanding that it isn't a matter of intelligence, but a matter of experience, means that we can systematically set about gaining the experience necessary. One way you could do this is by choosing an area that you can easily visit repeatedly without raising unnecessary attention to your presence. Establish a baseline for that location using one of the approaches discussed in the preceding sections. If you dedicate time to going back to that same location, confirming your baseline, and observing every single person that comes through that area, You will begin to build that database of experiences that is the key difference between experts and rookies. When you believe that you have reached a level of success in your predictions for people in that one area, where you are observing both the similarities as well as the subtle differences between every person that enters, and can effectively communicate those observations, move on to a new location and repeat the process. As you continue to do this at every location you commonly visit, you will also begin to make the practice of profiling a habit, requiring less mental attention from you to remember to profile. The deliberate approach to establishing baselines will help guide your efforts initially and ensure that you systematically cover the entire area. Initially, this approach may limit your ability to comprehend the bigger picture. However, over time, you will rely less on the methods and seamlessly blend the steps together into a smooth activity. One of the major difficulties you will need to overcome as you train yourself as a profiler is the lack of feedback you will receive for your observations. Without that feedback loop for your judgments and conclusions, you will never be able to learn from your mistakes and become a better observer. We recommend that you do this in areas where you can contact people and easily talk to people to confirm or deny your observations. It is why we often use Starbucks and malls during our classes, because there are places we can go today and observe with a relatively low level of risk. This process of contacting people will also require that you use some cunning to elicit the information that you are seeking without letting the person know you have been observing them, ultimately expanding all the file folders necessary for an expert profiler. The goal for this development is for you to increase not only the success rate of your predictions, but also the confidence you have in your ability to profile. However, we also want to ensure you are realistic in your abilities, understand your limitations, and don't become overconfident in your skills. In his book, The Invisible Gorilla, Christopher Chabris talks about his research on chess players and their perception of their rating, which shows how they rank compared with the rest of the chess world. He found that 75% of chess tournament players believed they were better than their published rating. To reduce the variables in the research, he checked back on the same players a year later to find that they maintained the same ranking. The ranking was accurate, but the perception of the skill possessed by the chess players was inflated. The reason I bring the research from The Invisible Gorilla up is because there will always be more research that you could conduct, and there will always be more scenarios that you could use to develop your ability or different settings for you to apply this skill. Overconfidence will result in incorrect predictions because you failed to take into account all of the information present. Learning is impossible without humility. We encourage confidence, not cockiness. Training resources on the web. In an attempt to further assist you on this journey, we have also created a website for you to continue your training and education. The goal of the site is to support this book. We provide articles on other aspects of profiling, different viewpoints on the topics in the course, a reading list with reviews of the books that we use to develop new instructors, which are referenced throughout this book, and most importantly, a video training section. The intent of the website is to provide a library of videos and other training for you to develop your file folders, with accompanying articles for you to expand your view of what profiling has to offer. Videos allow us to watch a specific incident as many times as necessary to learn how to analyze behavior and associate it with a threat while also providing feedback. When other venues are not available, this video training can be conducted from your home to build your profiling foundation. From the website, you can easily find our contact information, and we encourage you to tell us your stories so that we can continue to provide relevant and effective training. Tell us what you want to learn more about, and tell us about better ways we can use and apply the information discussed here. Visit www.cp-journal.com. A final letter. Dear listener, Our goal for this book was simple: to make Marines, soldiers, law enforcement officers, and anyone else who has dedicated their life to protecting our society more effective in hunting our enemies and increasing their ability to recognize threats. These areas will make Marines more survivable on patrol, both while deployed and at home. The information in this book has been previously inaccessible to most Marines. We hope we changed that. Developing into a profiler will be a roller coaster ride. It certainly has been for us. There will be times when you think that this is the most fascinating thing you have ever done in your life. There will be other times when the frustration will seem insurmountable, and you will want to take a break from analyzing every gesture that you are observing. That is completely natural. There will be times when you believe that your observations are absolutely spot on, and you will feel extremely confident in what you identify. Other times you will question yourself and feel that you are no closer to understanding humans than you were before you started studying this field. This is also natural, and you will get past it. But you have to stick to it. We do not claim to be experts. We only claim that we are striving to become experts and are taking the same journey that we hope we have inspired you to take. It isn't a journey that any of us will ever complete. As soon as you believe that you are an expert in your field, you will no longer have the drive to keep learning. Humans are diverse, adapting, and changing. There is always something to learn. The 6 domains of combat profiling and the content in this book should provide you with the foundation to grow in this pursuit. Good luck. Never forget. Never quit. Semper Fidelis. Patrick Van Horn, Jason A. Riley. This concludes Left of Bang by Patrick Van Horn and Jason A. Riley. Narrated by Danny Campbell. Copyright 2014 by Patrick Van Horn and Jason A. Riley. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Black Irish Entertainment, LLC, and was produced in the year 2015 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.